Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here is what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. A BBC Africa Eye investigation reveals how illegal opioid drugs manufactured by a company in India have reached the shores of West Africa with devastating impact.
The most worrying part of this is the fight against the drugs. It's an extremely difficult battle to win because the more the drugs are seized, the more they come in. And so if the source is not stopped, it's going to be very difficult for the authorities to be able to fight to win this battle against the drugs.
And who benefits from Senegal refining its own oil? It's Friday, the 21st of February. First, we go to Freetown. A social media fitness content creator and TV personality is currently in prison in Sierra Leone, awaiting trial for comments she made about the president and the first lady. Hawa Hunt, who has dual Sierra Leonean and Canadian citizenship, is accused of insulting President Julius Maada Bio and his wife, Fatma Bio, in a 25-minute video posted on Facebook in 2023, just as the country was preparing for elections. The video resurfaced and went viral. Last December, more than a year after the post, she was arrested on live television, where she was taking part in the Sierra Leonean reality TV show called House of Stars. Hawa is accused of transmitting insulting messages via a computer system. Prosecutors claim the video incited public disorder and damaged the reputation of the president and his wife. Despite apologizing for her video comments, her case was referred to the High Court for trial, and 2 months on, there's still no start date for that trial, and she's still being held on remand. Her family say they are concerned about her mental health and well-being. Her three children live in Canada. I've been speaking to her daughter, Alicia Hunt.
At first, when me and my family saw the, footage of my mom being arrested, we didn't really believe it. Because, we thought, no way could she be arrested for, words she said years ago and apologized for. But after confirming that she had actually been arrested, our hearts just dropped. And we were freaking out, trying to figure out how to help her from overseas.
She was arrested during a live show. Were you watching the show or were you looking at clips of the arrest later?
I was looking at clips of the arrest later. After I saw the arrest, I reached out to some of my mom's best friends here in Calgary, some of our very close friends, to try to figure out, first off, if she had actually been arrested, and then just, who do we, contact on our side from the Canadian government to see how we can assist her mom.
And when you started searching for information, what were you told about the charges against her and the reason why she had been arrested?
From the clip in the show, we did discover was that she was arrested for words used against the president and first lady. However, they did take more than a week to actually officially state her charges after her arrest. And from what I understand, they do have a certain amount of time where they do have to officially state charges when they arrest someone. So we were, quite worried about not actually knowing which law she had broken. It was mainly the Canadian embassy who were able to communicate her charges to me and kind of explain from there. I also did do a lot of research to kind of help us understand this law.
And have the authorities in Sierra Leone been in touch with you at all?
The authorities in Sierra Leone have not been in touch with me at all. The most I've gotten is some public feedback from government officials in Sierra Leone that was posted on Facebook.
And all this while, what was going through your mind concerning these events?
We were really just worried sick for, first off, her safety. There were a lot of malicious rumors going around the internet, and there still are. Sometimes I wake up and I see posts of people saying that my mom's been killed, and it's very scary to see and very scary not knowing that we never know when those rumors are true. So there's definitely been a lot of panic on our side. But now that I have appointed my mom an amazing lawyer, I definitely do feel like I have a lot better control of the situation and less anxiety around it.
Have you been able to make any contact at all with your mother in jail? And what did you learn by speaking or seeing her?
I am able to make contact with my mom through her lawyer. So when he goes to see her, sometimes he's able to video chat me when he's with her, and I'm able to speak with her through that way. Through speaking with her, I've been able to, you know, learn more about the conditions in there, you know.
What about your siblings? How have they been coping with this?
So I do have two siblings. My older brother is 25 years old, and my younger brother is 16 years old. Especially for my 16-year-old little brother, it's definitely not been easy on him. I've spent a lot of time having to comfort him, and especially in regards to people's cruel responses on the media saying that my mom deserves to be killed or deserves to be physically abused. That's really hard for especially a young boy to see about his mom. Our mental health hasn't been doing the best throughout this.
Are you able to tell us how things have changed for you personally over the past couple of months?
When this situation did first start, you know, right after my mother was arrested, I did have to take about a month off of work just because of the anxiety from it all. I was barely able to be out in public without having panic attacks or just genuinely feeling scared. Since then, I have gotten back to work. I've started, you know, hanging out with my friends again, but it did definitely affect me.
Do you have any plans to go to Sierra Leone yourself and follow up on the case more closely?
I have been told that it would put my safety at risk if I did go to Sierra Leone. I do wish I could feel safe traveling to Sierra Leone and help oversee the case, but I just don't feel safe in doing so.
Alicia Hunt, daughter of Hawa Hunt. The organizers of the House of Stars reality TV show issued a plea calling for Hawa Hunt to be forgiven and describing her as a strong woman who came from abroad to support Sierra Leone's dream to promote the country's entertainment and the less privileged. Now, the charges that Hawa Hunt faces come under the Cybersecurity and Crime Act of 2021. But rights advocacy organizations, including Amnesty International, have raised concerns about the law that is being used to prosecute her. Rashid Dumbuya is a human rights lawyer and the executive director of the Christian Lawyers Center, Legal Link. He's also representing Hawa Hunt. He says the law is intended to target serious cybercrime and suppress fraud, but is also being used to criminalize free speech in the country. This all comes after Parliament amended the Public Order Act in 2020, lifting the restraint on press freedoms and free speech, which was hailed as a historic and progressive step. But Mr. Dumbuya says there have been cases of journalists, politicians, and other social media influencers and artists who have been arrested and faced prison terms because of their criticism of state actors and leaders. He says these cases should not fall under the Cybersecurity and Crime Act.
It is the wrong use of the law. We believe the Cybersecurity and Crimes Law was passed or should really suppress fraud, child pornography, terrorism financing, and other serious criminal activities that occur through cyberspace. It is not supposed to be used against activists, artists, politicians, or ordinary citizens that express, you know, their view or dissenting voices against state actors or leaders in the country, and hence the concern from human rights groups.
How often is this law being used on citizens that you believe they are simply expressing their opinions and exercising their freedom of expression?
Many citizens, including activists, social media influencers, artists, have been investigated or even charged under this law due to some of their spoken words, their voice recordings, or in some instances, their social media posts against state actors.
In 2020, Sierra Leone took what many called a progressive step, and that's when the president passed the Independent Media Commission Act. How do these two pieces of legislation differ?
The government then did not only pass this progressive law, this amendment, but it also took a very powerful step when it repealed Part 5 of the Public Order Act of 1965, which criminalizes free speech, libel, and slander. Two progressive steps that the government took then that we saluted. And it's unfortunate that we are currently returning again to the criminal libel law era, where citizens, activists, and members of the press are criminally charged for what they say or publish against state actors. So we are saying, you've passed the law, you've abolished the criminal libel law, which was good, but you are having now another new law, which apparently suggests that nothing much has been done, because it has provisions that still appear to caricature the libel law that existed as far back as 1965 in our country.
So why then do you think that this Independent Media Commission Act, which you're saying is progressive, why do you think it's not being implemented?
So that's the question we are all don't have answers for, because we believe we pass laws to now, you know, change our attitudes and behaviors and make us more progressive and democratic in terms of response. So the IMC law exists to, at the very least, give journalists who have acted unprofessionally, you know, a pathway to hear their case before a panel of experts who understand how to deal with them, and to proffer recommendations that are civil in nature and which are much more correct in the given circumstances, because you don't need to jail somebody for saying something against you that you don't like or for making publications that you don't like. You can have civil remedies, you know, adequate and appropriate in those circumstances. For example, the IMC can order a retraction, a public apology, and in some instance, a fine or damages.
Do you think this aspect of social media is sort of presenting a new challenge in terms of putting content creators at increased risks, and also in terms of governments getting more heavy-handed in their responses? And I'm asking you because we've seen such cases happening in other countries as well. It's not just in Sierra Leone where people are getting arrested and punished for something they said about the government and posted on social media.
Governments should first of all understand that the social media is here to stay. So whatever they do across the world, across Africa, it will not stop people from being critical of them. They have to change their strategy, all right, in responding to criticisms and dissenting voices that come to social media. People have to speak, people have to talk, people have to express themselves. It's an inherent right, and you cannot suppress it all the way. At some point, you have to speak. So what we do is to ensure we rule well as governments, to be democratic in our response. And by so doing, we now silence the opposition by our good deeds. But to clamp people down, arrest them, is not the right response.
Human rights lawyer Rashid Dumbuya, we've reached out to the government for a response, but we have not yet had a reply. There is a crisis ensuing in West Africa. Highly addictive pills are flooding the streets disguised as medicine, triggering an opioid crisis.
My friend took drugs and introduced me to them. He could no longer afford to buy them for me, but I had gotten addicted. Whenever I feel pain, I take it for relief.
In Kano, northern Nigeria, local drug rehab worker Abubakar Maitumaki spoke about how opioids are ruining lives in his city, often the lives of children, some of whom abuse these substances in the open.
It's a time bomb, you know. Children, they can steal in the market. They can do anything to make money, to get drugs, you know. It's a problem of poverty, lack of parental care. They have to be in school, 8 years, 9 years, 10, 15. and now they are in the street. The problem of children addicted to drugs is increasing because it doesn't have cure.
Journalist Yahaya Mashedu has been investigating the situation in Tamale, Ghana, where a citizens' task force is proactively addressing drug hotspots. But where are these pills coming from? India. An Indian pharmaceutical company is manufacturing these unlicensed, highly addictive opioids and exporting them illegally to West Africa, where they are driving a major public health crisis in countries including Ghana, Nigeria and Cote d'Ivoire. That's what a BBC Africa Eye investigation has revealed. Avio Pharmaceuticals, based in Mumbai, makes a range of pills that go under different brand names and are packaged to look like legitimate medicines, but all contains the same harmful mix of ingredients, which is not licensed for use anywhere in the world, and an overdose can kill. I've been speaking to Yahaya, who begins by explaining what opioids are and how the abuse of drugs has gripped the streets of Ghana over the past decade.
Opioids are drugs that are used for pain relief, usually given to patients who have experienced extreme pain. Over the past one decade, we had what we call high-dosage tramadol on the streets of Ghana that the youth used to abuse and which caused harm to them. Fast forward, we do not have these high-dosage tramadol on the streets anymore. They have been replaced by a new cocktail of opioids that have come into the system and they are so widespread and easily accessible to people. This new cocktail of opioids include tafradol and other brand names. So if you look at all these opioids that we have coming into the system at the moment, they are the same drug under different brand names. So tafradol, for example, is made of two substances, tapentadol, which is like tramadol, but twice as potent. And we have also carisoprodol, which is a muscle relaxant. But this is so addictive that it has been banned in Europe. So these two substances are combined to produce tafradol. And it's the same two substances you would find in the other brand names like Timakin, Taramakin, Super Royal, and so on and so forth. The drugs that we have in the system now are not licensed to be used in any part of the world. They are illegal substances that do not have any medicinal purpose and are not supposed to be taken out as medicine. They are used as street drugs. And indeed, the manufacturers of these drugs know that these drugs are used as street drugs. So they do not have any medicinal purposes and they are not licensed to be used in any part of the world.
So what is the current situation then of the opioid crisis in Ghana and Nigeria and beyond?
I see a worsening situation of abuse of these drugs at the ghettos in Tamale and other parts of the northern region of Ghana with the new combination pills. And it's the same across the West African region. It is partly because these drugs have flooded the area and is so easily accessible. The addicts find it difficult to get help as a result of the lack of rehab centers. We do not have rehab centers around here. I spoke to a lot of young boys and young girls at the ghettos who are addicted to these drugs and who want to get clean, but they don't know where to get the help from because we do not have the rehab centers. But the most worrying part of this is the fight against the drugs. It's an extremely difficult battle to win because the more the drugs are seized and bent, the more they come in. And so if the source is not stopped, it's going to be very difficult for the authorities and whoever is concerned, the traditional rulers, the task force, to be able to fight to win this battle against the drugs.
Tell us about the people making these drugs and how they get them into West Africa.
For the past 2 years, I've been tracking the opioid routes and that led us to a pharmaceutical company in India that is manufacturing these drugs. Our undercover investigator posed as a businessman and was able to strike a deal with the manufacturers of these drugs who agreed to sell the drugs to him so he can take it to Africa. So he told our undercover investigator that they sell the drugs to people of West Africa. And usually they find a way of clearing it from the side of India. And when the drugs arrive in the importing country, the one responsible for importing it into the country would also clear it from side of the importing country. And we have seen evidence of a pharmaceutical company in Ghana that they have imported several millions of the tablets into the country. That's one part of it. What we do not know is how they are able to get it into the country on the blind side of the port authorities. But one other way the drugs are able to get into the country is through unapproved borders, unapproved routes across the country. So they are able to smuggle the drug from neighboring African countries into Ghana.
And how does it then move? Once it's in West Africa, whether it's in Ghana, what kind of networks are used to get it to other countries?
Right. So it's a bit difficult to tell. From the side of Nigeria, the Nigerian authorities have indicated that some of the drugs that they find in Nigeria come in from Ghana. So as to how they are able to smuggle it from Ghana to Nigeria, we are not able to tell.
So what actions then are being taken by the community to address this crisis?
So the worsening situation of abuse of the drugs caught the attention of the traditional authorities in this area, who felt the need to help in the fight against the drugs. So they gave the task force their support and asked them to seize and ban the drugs when they find them. And several community members have volunteered information to the task force as regards the points of sale of these drugs. And that has helped a lot in the fight against the drugs. So the task force usually will conduct raids at places that they suspect or they have information that these drugs are being sold or are being hidden or are being used. And they seize the drugs from the peddlers and the users and they ban them.
It does sound, though, like it's a huge business. What is the government doing in Ghana about this?
So the government of Ghana over the years has been looking at regulation, has been looking at enacting laws to control the importation, the manufacture, and the use of these opioids. So the Narcotics Control Commission, the Ghana Food and Drugs Authority, all have acts that deal with the importation, the use, and the manufacture of these opioids. So there are regulations around it. But it's important to note that around the time these laws were enacted, we didn't have these new opioids in the system. So it's not something that people have much knowledge about. So people think that these new ones are still tramadol. So they call it tramadol, even though we know it's different from tramadol because the substances that are used that are combined to make these new opioids are completely different.
And after your investigation, were you able to put your evidence to this Indian pharmaceutical company? And what did they say about that?
So we wrote to the pharmaceutical company telling them about what we have found. They did not respond. The new ones that we have today are more potent and stronger than the ones that were in the system about 10 years or so ago. Now, a lot more people have been introduced into the taking of these drugs because it's become so popular and so easily accessible that people who want to get access to it can get access to it. Now, some of them now do not take these drugs alone. They mix it with energy drinks to be able to get the high that they desire. So others will mix it with alcoholic drinks and so many other things. So the presence of this new cocktail of opioids has worsened the addiction situation in my part of the country. The situation is just a health-taking time bomb waiting to explode.
And do you think authorities in Ghana are treating this with the seriousness that it deserves?
As journalists, we have been reporting on this issue for quite some time now, especially in the northern part of the country. These drugs are more popular in the northern part of the country than it is in other parts of the country. We have been trying to bring central government's attention to this situation.
Thank you, Yahaya.
You're welcome.
Investigative journalist Yahaya Mashedu. In response to this investigation, the Indian drugs regulator told the BBC that the Indian government recognizes its responsibility towards global public health and is committed to ensuring India has a responsible and strong pharmaceutical regulatory system. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Senegal has started refining its own oil for the first time in history. Although the country has had a refinery since 1961, it previously only processed imported oil. Now it is using oil extracted from the Sangoma field in west-central Senegal, where production began in June last year. The oil field is operated by an Australian company called Woodside Energy. Billions of dollars are expected in revenue, as well as accelerated transformation of the economy. I've been speaking to someone watching the development in Senegal, Awa Traore, who is a senior international consultant in the Just Energy Transition. Is this a big moment for the country?
Yeah, it's a big moment in the sense that compared to other countries, Senegal is a very new country, you know, who has made discoveries recently in the oil and gas industry. And they have just kickstarted last year. So, yeah, so being able to sort of refine its own oil, yeah, can be considered as a huge step in that development.
One wonders if they have a different approach to its own oil compared to other African oil-producing nations.
I think that the comparison with other countries that have a long history of oil production is quite premature, because it's too early to make a benchmark. But anyway, I think that their approach is rooted in the new government long-term strategy linked with the transformational national agenda by 2050 that is really aiming at revolutionizing the industry sector and by so doing achieve environmental sovereignty.
As we move ahead, tell us why the people of Senegal should care about this and in what ways it's going to benefit them that their country is refining its own oil.
I mean, like some of the Senegalese believe that a transition to renewable energy would be a better approach for the development of Senegal. But at least with this development, what they hope for is really seeing jobs created, seeing price of fuel lowered. I think these are basic sort of expectation they would have. The Senegalese, at the end of the day, what they expect from having their country producing oil, refining, is to have domestic prices of fuel lowered.
How many years do you think then it will take for the people in Senegal to feel that they are benefiting from the country being able to produce its own oil? Because we've seen other countries in Africa that do produce the oil, but they still import it. They still import refined oil like Nigeria.
Exactly. I mean, like, there is no actually really success stories you can quote when it comes to oil and gas. And if you take history of, like you've mentioned, Nigeria, I don't think it has changed much or it has impacted positively the Nigerian economic system. I don't think so. So your question is quite difficult to answer. Why? Because even the predicted revenues that are projected are uncertain with Senegalese case right now. There are mentions that we will get billions of dollars in terms of revenues in the long term with this. But there is no clear or proper framework that is exactly, we are certain 100% that this is going to generate revenues.
How committed do you think Senegal is in making sure that these frameworks are implemented then?
So they actually have in the transition, at least in the energy sector, they want to have a share of 50% for renewables and have a 50% share of gas. And with these numbers, what we're aiming for is really having the proportion of renewables higher than the oil and gas.
And does this oil and gas support the other 50% you talked about? Because the argument also has been that some of these developing countries do need to use the resources that they have, renewable or not, for now, for their own economic development. Don't you see such a case for Senegal?
You know, we always tend to make economic analysis based on what we'll be expecting in terms of money. But in reality, we also weigh the costs. Did we make a cost analysis of if we go through this, what are the impacts that we will have? Because while I'm speaking to you, fishing communities are really worried and are seeing, you know, already certain bad effects of these oil and gas operations. We cannot 100% say, because I always love to back everything that is said with research and reliable data. But from the work that we do with a platform of partners here in Senegal, it sounds that the fishermen are really not able to catch enough fish anymore. So fish scarcity is a reality, and the fishing sector is among the key sector here in Senegal. So we need to balance the analysis and make sure that whatever approach we take for development, at the end of the day, is Senegalese people benefiting from it.
Thank you, Awa, for your time.
Thank you very much.
Senior International Consultant in the Just Energy Transition, Awa Traore in Senegal. Focus on Africa was produced by Patricia Whitehorn, Nyasha Michelle and Bella Hassan in London, Frenny Joey in Nairobi and Blessing Aderoba in Lagos. Connie Sharp was a senior journalist in charge and Francesca Dan was a technical producer. Our editors are Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Charles Gitonga. Goodbye for now.